This is Alan A. McRae's lecture on Jeremiah. This is lecture number 2 on Jeremiah by Alan A. McRae. Now, we had a question for today, and that was to look at Jeremiah chapter 21. In Jeremiah chapter 21, the first question was the character of the particular king. Of course, you notice that in this chapter, the king who was discussed is Zedekiah. And you notice that Zedekiah here was interested in knowing what the will of the Lord was, so he was a king that had at least some belief in God. And then the second question was about the character of the leading officials, though I don't think you learned anything about that from this particular chapter. The third question was the means God used to protect Jeremiah. And here again, there is nothing told. The king certainly did not try to injure Jeremiah. The king showed a certain amount of favor to him. The fourth question shed light on how the book of Jeremiah was formed. You get some information on this from this chapter, but you might need another chapter, a later chapter than what I assigned, in order to get a fuller answer. The fact is, Zedekiah here is the important king of this chapter, and as I told you last time, most of Jeremiah's ministry was in the reign of the three kings, Josiah, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah. And this is the last of the three. So when you meet him early in chapter 21, it would suggest that the arrangement of the book is not strictly arranged chronologically. When you come to a later chapter and you find that you are dealing not with Zedekiah but an earlier king, you get clear proof that the book is not chronologically arranged, as are most of the other prophetic books. Here you have not merely a reference to Zedekiah, but an event in his reign which is described before the events described in the reign of an earlier king. Then the second passage I wanted you to look at was Jeremiah chapter 26. It highlights an interesting event. In fact, there were two important events. Jehoiakim made an attempt to get Jeremiah killed, and he succeeded in getting another prophet killed who, we are told, made predictions very similar to Jeremiah's. Here, in answer to the first question, you find that the character of this king was that he was a vicious enemy of God and of God's prophet and desired to destroy God's prophet. You have very clear evidence here of the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question is, of course, also clear that Jehoiakim's officials protected Jeremiah. They interfered. They made arguments to the king. They protected Jeremiah, though the king's hatred of what Jeremiah was saying was so great that the king sent clear to Egypt to capture another prophet, as I said, that was substantially saying the same thing as Jeremiah did, and to have the other prophet brought back and killed. You have very definite evidence as to the character of Jehoiakim, and evidence that he had officials that interfered with his doing what he desired. Third, the means God used to protect Jeremiah was through godly officials in the king's court. We have clear evidence here that this was not an absolute monarchy, that while the king had very great power, his power was also greatly affected by the attitudes of his leading officials. Then fourth, the way the book of Jeremiah was formed, again, here is an event in the reign of Jehoiakim. In fact, early in his reign, I told you last time he reigned 11 years, and this event happened in the fourth year of his reign, and the previous chapter told about an event that happened in the reign of Zedekiah. You don't get much information, but you do get a little information about the way the book was formed here. Then the next chapter I wanted you to look at was chapter 36 of Jeremiah, which had a very interesting event, an event that must have occurred after the event described in chapter 26. There was a situation in which Jeremiah thought it unwise to appear personally before the king. That would suggest strongly that the previous event had occurred. Jeremiah dictated his prophecy. By the way, that word prophecy, used today, generally means a prediction of the future. The Hebrew word to prophesize, however, means, quote, to speak out, to present a message, end quote. It does not necessarily mean a predictive message. So in the Bible, while the prophet's work includes prediction, prediction is by no means all of a prophet's message. Probably less than half of a prophet's message is prediction. The prophecies of Jeremiah, the statements that he had made denouncing the sin of the nation, had already affected Jehoiakim to such an extent that Jeremiah did not wish to appear publicly at this time, but he dictated his material to Baruch, and he read it publicly. We find that the officials wanted the king to read what Jeremiah wrote, and then when the king wanted to destroy it, the officials tried to stop him, but the king went ahead and destroyed what Jeremiah had written anyways. Jeremiah hid and redictated the material. We read he added many other similar words in the new scroll. From what we learn about the character of Jehoiakim, it is already clear from the previous chapter, and it is made even clearer in this chapter 36. The character of the leading officials, already suggested in the previous chapter, is here equally strongly suggested. This means God used two ways to protect Jeremiah. First, having the officials to protect him, and second, causing Jeremiah to hide rather than showing himself at this juncture. Some people think that it would be the duty of a man like Jeremiah in this situation to come out publicly and present himself, but the Bible shows that there are times when one can do God's work best by avoiding danger. Now, the fourth point, on which we had little evidence up to this point, you have a great deal of evidence in this chapter. We find in this chapter that Jeremiah wrote these things in a scroll specifically for this occasion. Whether he had ever written down anything before in a permanent form, we do not know, but it is obvious here that Jeremiah thought back over what he had said at various times and the messages God had given him, and he wrote them down. But they were destroyed by Jehoiakim. But he rewrote them and added many other words, and this suggests that the book of Jeremiah does not represent what God gave the prophet 1 year and then the next year and so on in chronological order, but that Jeremiah begins with such a writing and then he went back and rewrote it, inserting various matters into his new work. It is clear that Jeremiah later made insertions into his writing, or Baruch did in the final copy of it. This chapter is very important in giving us an idea of just how the book of Jeremiah was formed. Then I ask you to look at chapter 38. In chapter 38, we again find Zedekiah, but we have more information about him here. We have his officials wanting Jeremiah killed, and we have Zedekiah telling them there is nothing he can do to oppose them, that they can do whatever they want. And so we find the officials here having great power, but nevertheless not going against what was clearly Zedekiah's desire. They didn't kill Jeremiah, but they did put him into a deep cistern. They hoped he would die of natural causes, but they were not willing to oppose what was obviously the king's desire to the extent of killing Jeremiah. We find King Zedekiah talking to Jeremiah and desiring to find out what Jeremiah wants, but afraid for his life if his officials knew that Jeremiah was actually talking to him. We have a situation here that shows the character of Zedekiah and does not show him as an overtly wicked man. My inclination is to think that Zedekiah was a man who, under normal circumstances, would have been a good man, who would have drifted along following what he thought was the Lord's will and desiring to promote those who supported God's purposes. But he had officials who were very strongly opposed to him, and he was afraid of those officials. He was a timid man. He was one who was in a rather difficult situation and one who hid his real desires. There are many rulers in history who have been in that situation. There are many officials in every sort of organization who from time to time find themselves in that position. The number of completely absolute rulers in the world's history is comparatively small. They have to have not only a system that gives them the right to be absolute rulers, but also the power and the personality to put down whoever opposes them and to maintain their power, no matter how great the opposition. I think Zedekiah was a man who in normal times would easily get the reputation of being a good king. Now in Kings, where it speaks of him, specifically 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 18 and following, it says that he was an evil king, that he did evil in the sight of the Lord. I think he did do evil in the sight of the Lord. He was a man who did not have the character to resist the difficulties that he faced and to stand for the Lord in difficult situations. But we find that his officials were quite a different type. I believe these four passages give us a clue to an important development. King Josiah reigned for 31 years, during which time Jeremiah began his ministry. King Josiah, in his 18th year, led a great revival, which is described at great lengths in Chronicles, specifically 2 Chronicles chapter 34, verses 1 and following, and there is considerable information about this revival in the book of Kings as well, 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 1 and following. In the years between Josiah's 18th year and his 31st year, in those 13 years, we can be sure that as positions became vacant, as men died or retired, Josiah filled those positions as he could with men who honored the Lord and desired to follow him. The result was that when, after a three-month period in between Jehoiakim, the son of King Josiah became king, there were men in the important official positions whom Josiah had appointed or whom Josiah had given special opportunities to advance. These men were men of the type of officials that Josiah wanted. Jehoiakim, in his desire to do wickedness, was greatly hampered by the fact that he had a group of godly officials working with him. They were in a position where for them to come right out and very strongly oppose the king might have subjected them to being killed, at least to losing their position, but where they could still do a great deal to alter his attitudes or to prevent them from being carried out in the royal court, they did. Thus we have a situation in the reign of Jehoiakim where he inherited royal officials, mostly godly officials, appointed by his father, and they were the ones who tried to protect Jeremiah. As early as the fourth year of his reign, when these two events happened, Jehoiakim, while his own power was very great, was greatly hampered by the strong influence of officials whom his father Josiah had appointed, many of whom had a very strong position with the people. It would have been very hard for Jehoiakim to dislodge them. But during the 11 years of Jehoiakim's reign, we can be sure that when one of the officials died or was dismissed or made some mistake that would give Jehoiakim sufficient cause to get rid of him, that he replaced them with ungodly men. And so when Jehoiakim died, again, there was a 3-month period in between, but then Zedekiah became king. Zedekiah was not in as strong a position as Jehoiakim, and that's because when Jehoiakim died, it was expected that he would be succeeded by his son, Jehoiachin. His son, Jehoiachin, however, reigned only 3 months because the Babylonian king came and took him off into captivity. For some reason, the people were greatly attached to this son, Jehoiachin. In the English translation, Jehoiakim has been represented by a K. The K-I-M part, Kim, has been represented by a K, and Jehoiachin has been represented, the CH, with a CH in his name, although in Hebrew there is no difference in the spelling of the names at this point. But we call the second king Jehoiachin and the first king Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin being the son of Jehoiakim. Well, getting to Jehoiachin, he reigned for 3 months, and then the Babylonian king seized him and took him off as a prisoner. The people felt that Jehoiachin was the rightful ruler, and so when he was gone, they considered his uncle, Zedekiah, as merely a sort of temporary regent, someone who was holding the throne until Jehoiachin came back, which they expected would happen very soon. Jehoiachin was only there 3 months as king, but Zedekiah is considered king and is listed as such. But the people still felt the rightful king was Jehoiachin and that he would come back soon. So when a man is considered as only filling in for his nephew, his power naturally isn't as great as a man whom they felt was rightfully king. Zedekiah, when he became king, doubtless had to contend with officials whom Jehoiakim had gradually gotten into power, whose character was like Jehoiachin's wicked father. So we have this alternation. God used the officials to protect his prophet in Jehoiakim's reign, and then later used King Zedekiah himself, despite his timidity, to save Jeremiah's life during the next 7 years from the officials. Those facts come out in these chapters that we looked at. We don't find anything from this chapter about the fourth question, and that is how the book of Jeremiah was formed. But I think for a real understanding of the book, we have to have an understanding of that feature of the role of the officials and their relationship to the king. By the way, I'd like to make another point. People often have the impression that the kings of Judah and Israel were absolute monarchs. Kings had tremendous powers, true, but they were very far from being absolute monarchs. You remember that King Ahab, one of the most wicked kings in the history of the northern kingdom, when he wanted Naboth's vineyard that was next door, in fact, he didn't think he could get it. We read that he sulked and tried repeatedly to buy the vineyard, but when Naboth wouldn't sell it, the king just sulked. It was his wife Jezebel who said, quote, "Why do you sulk like this? After all, you're the king. Why don't you do something about this?" End quote. And he said, quote, "There's nothing I can do." End quote. He clearly was not an absolute monarch. And then Jezebel asked him to give her his royal seal, and the indication was that she could act in his place, and she proceeded to hire people to lie about Naboth and to say that Naboth had cursed God and the king. Through these lies, Naboth was convicted and killed, and then it was easy to get his vineyard. That is a very clear proof that Ahab was certainly not an absolute monarch. Incidentally, you really need that fact to understand the story of Elijah's flight. You remember that Elijah stood on Mount Carmel and faced the prophets of Baal and proved that God was the true God. King Ahab was absolutely defeated on that occasion and went back to Jezreel. Elijah said there's rain coming, though there hadn't been rain for 3 years. But then we read that the next day Jezebel sent word to Elijah and said to him that by this time tomorrow you'll be in the same situation as these dead prophets of Baal that you killed. Well, Elijah was so frightened that he fled. Well, Jezebel couldn't possibly have injured Elijah at that time when he was a great hero to the whole nation for what he had done. And even if he hadn't been, she didn't have the power. Even Jezebel, in order to get rid of Naboth, she had to hire people to tell lies. She couldn't possibly have done that. Elijah's flight then was because he was so tired and took it for granted that he was simply being framed. So he became frightened, and instead of trusting God, he fled. But I think that knowing kings were not absolute monarchs is important to all of our Old Testament history. At this point, let me say something about the history. It is important. I hadn't intended to give it quite yet, but I was going to get to it. The history is stated clearly in the books of Kings, and some statements about it are made in Chronicles, and this is important, and I'm referring here to 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 1 and following, and 2 Chronicles chapter 34, verse 1 and following. They speak of King Josiah. King Josiah, who had this great revival in the 18th year of his reign, in the 31st year of his reign, heard that Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, was marching up through Palestine along the seacoast, heading to the north. Nobody knows why King Josiah felt that he must stop Pharaoh Necho, whether he felt that Necho had no right to go through his territory without first getting his permission, or whether he felt that Pharaoh Necho was going to interfere with events to the north, and he was interested in their coming out differently than Pharaoh Necho would have wanted them to. Whatever the case, we read in Kings and Chronicles, in passages 2 Kings 23, verse 29, and 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 20 to 24, that Josiah immediately took a force and rushed north from Jerusalem to the city of Megiddo. Megiddo is a place where the broad plain by the seacoast narrows down to a narrow pass, and then is a broader plain to the north of that. There's a little pass there at Megiddo that an army would have to go through, and where a small group could conceivably hold off a fairly large army. In fact, during the First World War, there was a rather important battle that was fought right at that place. There have been many battles at that place, and in fact, is this idea of battles there passes into the New Testament under the word, quote, Armageddon, end quote, which is a Greek way of saying, quote, the hill of Megiddo, end quote, which in Hebrew is Har Megiddo, and that comes across as Armageddon, and that word takes up the fact that many battles have been fought at this crucial point. And it was a crucial point because it is one where one could easily use a small force to hold up a larger one. Josiah, we read, went up to that place with a number of forces that he could rally rapidly together, for there had been no television reporters on the scene to give him immediate on-the-scene reports about what Pharaoh Necho was doing. He simply heard what was happening on the seacoast and rushed up quickly with his force and ordered Pharaoh Necho, who was ruler of a far greater power than Josiah had, not to pass through that pass but to stop. Pharaoh Necho, it says in Kings, said, "Get out of the way. I'm not interested in you. I have nothing against you. I'm coming up here to go north." Then in Kings, we have the Hebrew preposition al that is used to state what Pharaoh Necho is doing. "I am coming up here, al, the king of Assyria." That is, I'm coming up here, then there's this preposition al, and then the phrase, the king of Assyria. "It's nothing to do, I have nothing to do with you," he says. Well, how is this preposition al translated in the King James Version? It's translated as against, but in the NIV, it's to help, which sounds quite different. So the King James Version says, "I've come up here against the king of Assyria," whereas the NIV says, "I've come up here with the king of Assyria," or "to help the king of Assyria," and these two translations appear to be quite different. The King James Version, as I said, translates it against, and "I have come up against the king of Assyria, I'm not interested in you," whereas in the NIV, Pharaoh Necho says, "I have come up here for the king of Assyria," or "to help the king of Assyria, and I am not interested in you." Well, the first thing that happened was that Josiah was killed. They took Josiah's body and carried it back to Jerusalem. Now, let me go back and say something about what the preposition al means. The King James Version, as we notice, says, "I'm coming up against the king of Assyria." A few years ago, there were discovered cuneiform tablets which tell about the death throes of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire had for several centuries been the greatest force in the Near East. They had even conquered Egypt at one time, though they really hadn't held it for too long. Now, the Babylonians had been subject to the Assyrians, but then the Babylonians revolted. Now the Babylonians, together with a group called the Medes, were attacking the Assyrian Empire. They had attacked it and captured the leading city, Nineveh, and destroyed it in 612 BC. The Assyrians fought until 604 BC, but they were decisively defeated and their whole power ended as they ceased to be a power after that. The Babylonians took their place as great leaders in the Near East. Evidently, Pharaoh Necho, who owed his power to quite an extent to Assyrian support, came up there to help the beleaguered Assyrian Empire. That's made quite clear in the cuneiform tablets. So it was declared that the Bible was wrong because it said that he, Necho, came up against the Assyrians in 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 29. And as I said, that's the way it is translated in the King James Version. Well, there is a clear contradiction then between what history tells us and what we know about it, and the statement in 2 Kings 23:29, as it is translated in the King James Version, does appear to be a contradiction. However, I could easily say that in the last war, that is the Second World War, the United States fought, quote, with, end quote, Germany. But I could equally truly say that the United States fought, quote, with, end quote, England and France against Germany. I can use the word with in either sense. Prepositions often have a rather wide range of meaning. This Hebrew preposition, al, very frequently has the meaning of concerned or about, and so may have meant upon or near. It is used in both ways. Well, you may say, what a crazy language that one word has such a range of meaning. But I mention the range of our own English word with. In every language, prepositions are one of the hardest things to know exactly what range of meaning they cover. And so, this preposition, al, can just as well mean concerned as against. And as I said, the NIV, the New International Translation, or the New International Version, translated equally correctly as with the King James. The King James isn't wrong in its translation. The preposition can mean against. But, as we said, it can also mean with, or to help, so you have to pick within the range of meaning the one that fits, and the King James Version picked one that falls outside of what we know was clearly intended. Many people say, why bother to learn Hebrew and Greek? Your English Bible certainly gives you what the Bible said, and certainly the truths of God are clear enough in the English Bible that anyone can get all that is necessary for salvation from it. But when it gets into precise understanding of many points, the English simply cannot represent the original exactly. You don't learn Hebrew or Greek because you expect to make a better translation than what we already have. You learn these languages because you can see at a glance possibilities of meaning in the original that cannot all be put into any English translation. You can also see that certain possibilities of your English may be definitely ruled out by what there is in the original. Even though the English may be a good translation, it inevitably brings in meanings that were not in the original and leaves out some ideas in the original. That is true for any translation from one language to another language. This, then, was the death of Josiah, so he had no chance to designate who should succeed him. When Josiah died, the people of the land passed over the oldest son, Jehoiakim, and they took a younger son named Jehoahaz. They evidently thought Jehoahaz was a better man and made him king. But after Pharaoh Necho had carried on some warfare in the north, he made a trip back to Egypt, perhaps to get additional forces, because he continued fighting up there off and on for a few years. But on the way, he stopped in Jerusalem, and he seized the man the people had made king and carried him off to Egypt and made the oldest son of King Josiah king instead. He made Jehoiakim swear to be loyal to Pharaoh Necho, to whatever Necho might desire. That's the way that Jehoiakim became king, and Josiah had nothing to say about it. Jehoiakim reigned 11 years, and after that, when he died, the people were very fond of his son Jehoiachin. Just why, we don't know, because we don't know much about Jehoiachin. He reigned for 3 months, and at the end of the 3 months that he reigned, the king of Babylon came and carried him off to Babylon. When he was taken, the people made his uncle their king, another son of Josiah, named Zedekiah, evidently a rather timid man, but a man whose desire was to be a good king, but who in actuality proved to be an evil king because of, principally, the strength of his officials, either in doing what they wanted or in leading him to do what they wanted. So he is called an evil king in the list of kings, but in each case the previous king had had no say in the circumstances that had occurred in determining who the successor would be. Now, I think this is a very interesting thing, the way that the influence of each of these three kings carried over into the next reign through the officials whom they had appointed. It would be pretty hard to understand the events of Jeremiah's life without understanding the relationship between the kings and their officials and how the officials were appointed. Now, we looked last time at the call of Jeremiah, and that call, we noticed, contained a very definite prediction of the downfall of Jerusalem in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 14. Here was a specific prediction. Quote, "Their kings, that is, the kings of the northern kingdoms, will come and set up their thrones in the entrance of the gates of Jerusalem." End quote. They will set up their thrones in the entrance of the gates. In ancient times, that's where business was conducted, in the gates. We find many places in the Old Testament where we read of events that occurred at the gates. So we read in chapter 39 the names of the officials who would sit there at the gate as they determined what they would do with Jerusalem after it had been taken. So there was a specific prediction in that verse that was literally fulfilled later on. Then Jeremiah continues, quote, "I will pronounce my judgments on my people because of their wickedness," end quote. But in verse 17 of chapter 1, the Lord continues speaking to Jeremiah. The last three verses of this chapter give a promise to Jeremiah, a tremendous promise, a promise that he says in verse 18 that, quote, "Today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall," end quote. Now, can anybody who says that we have to take everything literally in the Bible tell me how Jeremiah became a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall? It is clear that he said, "I will make you very strong so that you cannot be destroyed." It is clearer and more beautiful as figurative language, but it is figurative language. I always say that figurative language is like salt. You put salt on a dish and you add greatly to the tastefulness of the dish, but if you pour the whole bucket of salt in it, you completely ruin it. When somebody says something like, quote, "Revelation is a symbolic book, everything is symbolic for something else," end quote, he is reducing the book of Revelation to just a collection of words that anybody can make mean anything. And of course, the Lord does not give revelation of that type. He may include figurative language, but the greater part must inevitably be literal language. But figurative language adds greatly to the beauty of any production and also may add to its understandability, because by using a good figure, you can often give a lot of meaning that would perhaps take many words to say literally. And so God says that he is going to make Jeremiah a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against Jeremiah, but will not overcome him. That is a tremendous literal prediction in figurative language. It is a prediction specifically given to Jeremiah. Now, in chapter 26, you read how there was another prophet who gave substantially the same prophecies Jeremiah did, and that the king sent to Egypt and got him and brought him back and killed this prophet. This was King Jehoiakim. So we see that this is a prediction, but not in general for anyone who stands for God, that all opposition will be overcome. God may choose to have us suffer or die for his cause, just like this other prophet. Very often through a martyr, God has done much more through someone's death or seeming failure. We cannot tell by which method God gives us apparent success or apparent failure. But God says in the case of Jeremiah that Jeremiah would not be overcome because God would be with him and would rescue him. We can be sure that if God has a specific thing for us to do, he will protect us until we fulfill the task. But we do not know that though our failure seems apparent, if we are doing our best and keeping our eyes on the Lord and trying to serve him in all things, our apparent failures may really be what God had in mind and something through which he uses us. So God wants us to keep our eyes on him and be conscientious of his presence and overruling power at all times. We are to trust him to give us success in what we undertake. If that's his will, he will accomplish his will and give us contentment and peace of mind. If seeming success is not his will, well, it may be because through our seeming failures, he will give success, even though it may seem like failure to us. In God's work, in God's eyes, even our seeming failures are successful. And this ends lecture number 2 by Alan McCrae on Jeremiah.